Morning's newsreader. In a moment here on BBC Radio 4, we return for the last time this series to the Museum of Curiosity with John Lloyd and Anna Tashinsky. But first, a preview of Tuesday's 6:30 comedy.
On BBC Radio 4, how well would you do without sight?
Susie, who's this laughing?
That's Adele.
It is Adele, well done!
Well, let's find out how comedians cope when we force them to live in an audio-only world.
Well, that one is either a 20-year-old woman or a 5-year-old boy.
If that's a 5-year-old boy, he smokes.
Is this a pound or £2?
That is a pound.
It's a £2!
Damn it!
You heard it here first with me, Chris McCausland.
And I can tell you that you are...
wrong.
I'm so sorry and angry.
Tomorrow evening, 6:30 comedy on BBC Sounds and Radio 4.
Museum of Curiosity.
Hello, my name's John Lloyd and I'm the Professor of Ignorance at Solent University. Welcome to the Museum of Curiosity, a huge repository of answers to questions you never even dreamed of asking. And here's our dream curator, Anna Tashinsky.
Hello, John.
Hello, Anna. And what have you been up to in the museum this week?
I have invested in a couple of display plinths for the ancient Roman gallery. I've got this lovely modern one and a beautiful antique one. They are, of course, Plinth the Younger and Plinth the Elder.
I see my dreadful punning is finally rubbing off on you.
Well, when in Rome.
This is excellent news. Now let's meet today's steering committee, immigration lawyer and comedian Sakisa Bostick-Barnes, cultural entomologist and entrepreneur Bridget Zadie Nichols, and best-selling author and explorer Major Levison Wood. Hello.
Hello.
Well, you're all impressively busy people, but Anna and I are also interested in what you do in your spare time.
Yes, Sakisa, I think you're a solicitor who loves wrestling. Is that right?
That would be correct. Watch wrestling 4 times a week, minimum.
Good to know.
So, Bridget, your main area of interest is insects, but you're also, I think, a trained boxer. Do you have gloves for both kinds of activity?
I'd say socks would be more useful for insects because they usually go for your ankles. Gloves for boxing, I would really recommend them. When I didn't wear them for the first time, it was at Christmas. I was at home with my father, who was my coach at the time, and we ended up having a bit of sparring, and he managed to do an uppercut, punched me across the jaw. I bled out onto the turkey. And I ended up in A&E on Christmas Day, which kind of ended my career because he felt too guilty to coach me again.
Lev, you're an explorer and a documentary maker, but you have also done a lot of parachuting in your time. Would you say that is a good way to unwind?
I was a terrible parachutist for a start. I'm afraid of heights, which is not a great thing when you're a professional paratrooper in the army. But having sort of broken all of my limbs at least twice now, I'm sort of following more pedestrian pursuits.
Now, Sakisa, you seem to have 3 full-time jobs. You're an immigration lawyer, primarily representing asylum seekers, but you're also a comedian. And if those 2 weren't enough, you also travel the country as a cabaret dancer. As well as multiple jobs, you also have multiple identities. Sakisa, Twix, and Onyx Fatal. So which alias do you use when appearing in court?
Yes, we use our full real name, which is double barrel name, which is quite annoying for me in life because everyone messes up my real name, Sakisa, in general. So this is why I started calling myself Twix when I started doing stand-up comedy, which is a weird thing to talk about because I'm not going to get into it. It's a bit too sexual for this time of day.
And Lev, have you ever used an alias? Have you ever had to use an alias in your travels?
When I was walking the Nile, I arrived in Uganda and I'd already been walking for about sort of 3 months at this stage and I'd sort of acquired quite a following. And there was a certain rap group in Uganda that made a rap song all about my little stroll. And they called me the Tembula, which in the Baganda language means the walking man. So I arrived in Uganda to my own soundtrack, which was very weird. Yeah.
Sakisa, you were born in the UK, weren't you? But you spent most of your childhood in Barbados. Do you go back to Barbados a lot?
I do try to. Obviously, the pandemic was quite hard. And I've not been back in about 3 years. And I'm really quite missing home at this moment.
It's such a great country, isn't it? We took the kids when they were very small. And at the time, our nanny was super nanny, Jojo Frost. It was her first job as a nanny. And her dad was a Fulham builder called Mick, who's a brilliant guy. He used to take the family to Barbados every year. So Jojo knew all the local dudes on the beach. It was the most fantastic holiday because you went straight in as if you belonged there.
Barbados,
you know?
People are very friendly in
aren't
general.
They just?
We always would encourage someone to have rum.
When Jojo was on this program a couple of series ago, that was her donation, a bottle of Mount Gay rum.
Good for her, yeah. Yes. It is the best rum, and I will say that on the BBC.
Other rums are available. I'm obliged to say that legally.
Rum and dancing, I feel, it's got a very strong, much better dancing tradition than we have over here, doesn't it? You do some dancing, don't you?
I do quite a lot of dancing. Obviously, coming from the Caribbean, we're notorious for dancing. We just like to have some fun. So dancing is also great for the soul. And if you've got having a bad day, do some dancing. If you're having a good day, do some dancing.
I dance every morning. And if I'm too tired to dance with my entire body, I put the music on and dance with my eyebrows until I feel I can open my eyes. Really works.
With your eyebrows?
Yeah.
Oh, wait, can I?
Well, that's very strong.
I'm trying to do it now.
Is this to wake yourself up in the morning?
Yeah, if I'm having difficulties opening my eyes, then I'll dance with my eyebrows until I feel that the time has come that I should release my balls.
Well, thank you, Sakisa. I can see you're the ideal person to call for advice if I ever commit a serious offence by dancing in public, for example. So coming to you now, Bridget, you started out as a comedy performer but have reinvented yourself as a cultural entomologist and entrepreneur who in 2004 established Pestival, showcasing the beauty and importance of insects to human arts and culture. Since 2020, you've been a Churchill Fellow and your mission, should you accept it, is to save the world's insects from extinction. You're celebrating insects, but to paraphrase the life of Brian, what have the insects ever done for us?
Well, since 1980, about 45% of insects have died out. And, you know, without them, we probably wouldn't exist. And we're about to, in the next 10 years, if we don't start to look after the planet better, lose all of the insects. So then I'm assuming we go next. Because people don't realise that insects are aerating the soil, which helps the plants to grow, and the plants, you know, 80% of them are pollinated by insects. And on top of that, they even get rid of all the debris and rubbish and poop that we leave behind. They just clean it all up. So they do the job of running the planet, and we don't even thank them. We don't pay them. They just get on with it. They don't have any egos. So I think they've done quite a lot, actually, John.
Fun facts here, Bridget. I've got an insect named after me, believe it or not. A new species of crane fly, which was discovered in the Western Himalayas. Tipula levisioni. They spelt my name wrong, but that's fine.
Oh, no. That is the pinnacle of success.
The pinnacle of success, having a daddy long legs named after me, which is wonderful.
So finally, Bridget, we briefly mentioned Pestival earlier.
Yeah.
A lot of people went to Pestival, didn't they?
There'll never be as many people as insects that went to Pestival. And I did have a funny moment when I decided to call it Pestival because obviously there's a bit of hubris in that. Lots of people don't like insects, so let's face that head on. But a director of one of the insect charities, who shall remain nameless, wrote to me quite a stinky letter saying that how dare you call your festival Pestival? I've done years of good PR for insects to get people to like and respect them, and now you're taking us way back into the dark ages with the insects. And he said, if you had a football festival, would you call it Hoonigaville? He's like, well, that's quite good, actually. I might do. But that aside, 200,000 people ended up coming over one weekend, and he ate his words and became a great ally. So Pestival remained as a great celebration
brilliant.
Of the insect world.
But talking of eating his words, do you serve insects? Because there's quite a vogue for eating insects. They've been eaten all over the world, haven't they, for centuries. But do you serve them up?
You know, as you said, people do eat them all over the world as a main food source. And they are great in terms of high protein, low fat. And you can farm them very easily and you don't have to deforest. But I think in the West, instead of coming up with another thing to eat to help the growing population still feed themselves. It'd be much more sensible if we distributed food better and waste less rather than coming up with eating insects.
Mm. Well, thanks, Bridget. And if we decide to hold a festival in the museum, we'll call you first. But there may have to be some negotiation about what's going to be on the menu in the canteen. So over to you now, Lev. You are an award-winning writer and photographer with 10 books and several critically acclaimed documentaries under your belt, covering your extraordinary journeys in over 100 countries. You're a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society and a British Army officer who served extensively in Afghanistan, and you've since travelled the whole length of the Nile, made an entire circuit of the Arabian Peninsula, and covered the Himalayas from end to end, all of it on foot. You've walked literally thousands of miles, putting the proclaimers to shame. Where do you get your shoes?
The word explorer is a bit of a weird one in this day and age. People sort of think it's a bit old-fashioned and outdated. So when people ask me what I do, I call myself a shoe designer because I have actually designed my own shoes, which is great fun, yeah. And I took great pleasure in sort of, you know, hanging out with all these fashionistas and choosing the colour and the cut and the cloth and the, you know, the insoles. And I actually made them with Kevlar insoles so that they're not necessarily bulletproof, but certainly when you're walking through the bush, you know, you don't get a big spike through your sole. So yeah, there we go. I can't make my own shoes.
Oh, that's fabulous. I'm fascinated, Lev, because I wouldn't say I'm physically very brave. Were you born fearless or is it something you had to work at?
I wouldn't say fearless. I spent a lot of time facing my fears head on. Like I say, I've been very fortunate with my job to sort of travel a lot, to go and see different places around the world. And as a sort of, you know, as a soldier, an ex-soldier, then I've got a slightly different appreciation for risk, because when you've been to Afghanistan and been shot at, then everything else sort of pales into insignificance, really. Mm.
Although, I mean, a lot of the risks you've taken since then have still been quite major. And it makes me wonder, for instance, when you went from Iraq to Lebanon, but via the Arabian Peninsula, which is kind of like going from London to Brighton via the Shetland Islands. But this is at a time when so many people in these countries would desperately want to get out. What makes you want to go the other way?
I suppose that's the role of exploration in this day and age, is to go to places where a lot of people, frankly, wouldn't want to go to, and shine a spotlight onto important causes. Because, you know, often places, whether it's Yemen or Afghanistan or Iraq, they're only ever in the news for all the wrong reasons. And I like to go and shine a bit of a spotlight on the real human stories. Mm-hmm. And I've met some amazing people on my travels. And, you know, I went to Syria a few years back when the fight against ISIS was on. And actually, I think one thing that we all share in humanity is a sense of humor. And I'll never forget going down the road from Homs to Damascus. I had to get back before the sunset because there was a curfew on. And it's times like that that you really don't want the petrol light to go on, because it was, you know, everything to the east of the road was still under ISIS control. And so we were struggling to find a petrol station. And when I finally did find one, as I was paying for the fuel, a coach turned up in the forecourt. And all these young men got off this bus, you know, big beards, black bandanas. And I thought, oh dear, these do not look like the good guys. As I was sort of shuffling to hide behind the sort of crisp counter in this little shack, one of these young lads came over to me and said, "Salam alaikum." And I responded in my best Arabic, "Walaikum salam." And he looked me up and down and said, in perfect English, "So where are you from then?" I thought, right, okay, well, I can't lie here. I'm going to say I'm from England. He said, "Oh, I love England. I've been there many times." I thought, right, okay. So I keep the conversation going. I said to him, so who are you lot then? He said, "Oh, we're ISIS." At which point my face went white. I think my trousers probably went a different colour. And he just burst out laughing. He said, "Oh, I'm only joking. We're not ISIS. We're Hezbollah." And they were indeed Hezbollah. And it's a great place of explaining that he was on his gap year, volunteering for Hezbollah, fighting against ISIS whilst waiting to go to university. I said, "Oh, right, which university are you going to?" And he said, "Oh, I'm just doing my UCAS form for Leeds right now, actually." So very bizarre, but you meet these incredible people. I think it is that sense of humour that unites people all around the world. And you find even in the darkest circumstances, people get through it with a bit of banter.
A risky one.
So, but Bridge, you have been on a really strange adventure in lockdown.
It was an accidental adventure, John. It was back in end of February, beginning of March 2020. And I went for a weekend trip to Norway to visit this Swede that I'd met in London. And then lockdown happened. I just about knew his surname. And Norway was the first country in Europe to close its borders. So I couldn't leave.
And this is north of the Arctic Circle, right?
Yeah, north of the Arctic Circle. Very dark, very cold. So I had to make a life for myself all of a sudden. But because I was shielding, I wasn't allowed to leave when I could leave until they'd invented a vaccine. So I decided to buy a cabin on a fjord with no running water or electricity to pass the time. You know, the toilet wasn't flushing. Let's make that very clear. And it was at the bottom of the garden. So going to the toilet was an adventure in itself. The nearest shop was a 5-hour walk.
Across a frozen lake, I think, didn't
well,
you say?
Well, no, the shortcut was across the frozen fjord. So if I'd gone around the fjord, it would have taken 5 hours. But if I went across the fjord, which I couldn't go by boat because the fjord, which is the sea, froze over, I could get to the shop in 1.5 hours. So I had to get my backpack and walk across the frozen sea, which you could see and hear going...
It feels like you just told us a James Bond movie.
Yes.
Yeah. So you've set some very high bars for adventure, Lev and Bridget, and I don't want that to be intimidating for you, Sakisa, when I ask if you can top that with your greatest adventure of all time.
That was so loaded.
I can tell you, I cannot top that. No, I'm from South London. Just leaving the street is enough. Okay.
London's full of adventure opportunities.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Levison, for all those wonderful walking stories. And as you may be aware, the Museum of Curiosity is actually infinite in extent, you know, if you fancy a walk after lunch. Right, let's open the vault, please, Anna. And what unnecessarily elaborate contraption have you rigged up to make it hard for us this time?
I have this time enlisted the help of 12 Greek gods, and all they demand is the sacrifice of a goat every time we need to get in.
What?
And that's why, as you see, I brought little Billy along.
You can't be serious.
Now, Billy, what was it you were going to sacrifice this time? He says he's going to give up chocolate for Lent.
Ah, that's a relief.
I now declare the museum open for donations. Sakisa, what would you like to donate to the museum?
I would love to donate a Game Boy Color.
Okay. I personally love that, but why are you giving us one?
I think it is probably the most favourite or nation favourite game console there ever was. And it was my personal favourite to the point where I made my best friend get me one for Christmas a few years ago.
Wow. Yeah. And did you have one as a kid of your own?
My mum got me one, which was the one that was purple see-through. It was the best one.
I think I remember that. Could you sort of see the batteries?
Yeah,
inside
you could
it
see everything.
Yeah. It really reminds me of you get these fish really deep in the ocean, which have transparent skin and you can see all of their organs. And I think they're very cool. And in the same way, that one was definitely the coolest.
Yeah, I literally lived with that 24 hours. I only had like 4 games on it, but
what
it
games
was...
were you going for?
Super Mario Brothers. I had a wrestling game, Oz, and I had a Donkey Kong.
Did you play Tetris, surely?
Oh, yeah, I had Tetris as well.
Of course.
Tetris.
Did you ever get the Tetris effect? It's basically when you devote so much time and attention to any activity that all of your thoughts and mental images and dreams start to become that activity. So you sort of dream in blocks falling.
Oh, my God. So the only game I ever played was Tetris. I had to throw it away because I got the thing. And
did
I couldn't
you?
Go. Yes. And I couldn't go to sleep until I had built an entire wall up to the top of my screen in my head with my eyes closed.
See, I'm quite lucky that I never had that. And I have, for example, like downloaded Tetris on my phone. So I play it on the tube. And it's funny when I take out the Game Boy Color on the tube, little kids look at it like, what brick is this?
The sturdiness was remarkable because one Game Boy was actually blown up by bombing during the first Gulf War and was still playable afterwards.
Yeah, they were sturdy. It was like the 3310s.
They're like the cockroaches of the Game Boy World.
Yeah.
What about you two? So, Lev, are you a video gamer?
Well, I remember as a kid growing up in the 90s, I had an Amiga 500. I don't know if you remember one of those old contraptions. And it came with 3 games, or the 3 games that I have at least, was Cannon Fodder, Indiana Jones and Lemmings, all of which clearly had quite big impacts on my life.
Yeah, do you think you've been trying to live out the video game ever since.
Quite possibly, yeah.
Bridget, do you think that insects play games? Do you think they have a sense of fun?
I'm going to go for yes. They have fun. Hell yes.
How can you spot an insect having fun?
You know, some of them, they do definitely have their own personalities.
Oh,
there's
yeah.
so many of them, though.
Well, there's so many humans and they all have their own personalities. Don't be so speciest.
All right, well, Sakisa, thank you very much for your donation of the Game Boy Color. And are there any specifics for how you want us to display it? Like, which color would you want?
I would like the transparent one, please.
Thought that would come. And then is it going to come with games? And are we going to let people in the museum play the games?
I think it will come with Tetris mm-hmm. and Super Mario Brothers. And you can play them, but you only get one round to play them.
Good discipline.
Yeah, you've got to have discipline.
Well, thanks, Sakisa, for your addition of the Game Boy Color to the museum, and that should keep the pesky millennials away from the precious stuff.
So next up, Bridget, what exhibit would you like to donate to the museum?
I would like to offer the museum a termite mound.
I'm very excited about this because they're amazing things, but why is it that you'd like to donate a termite mound?
Termite mounds are just scratching the surface because they're what you see. So if you're in Namibia or Brazil or somewhere exotic like that, then you'll see this giant mound, which is actually a chimney. And it's usually pointing to the sun. And the sun will heat up the chimney and heat up the air in the rest of the mound, which is actually all underground. And there's these giant mega cities underground. They farm, they eat, they lay eggs, they do everything underground. And termites are actually blind cockroaches, not ants. This is the only social insect that has a king and a queen, not just a queen. Obviously, the queen is bigger than the king. He's a little tiny thing and the queen's really big. But when they build their home, the king and queen will throw in some mud, spit and poop and build their chamber inside this underground world. And then that's it. That's their prison for the rest of their lives. And they can live up to like 20, 30 years. And all she does is lay eggs.
It's one every 3 seconds, the eggs, apparently.
Yeah, she's she just pops them out.
Like a machine gun.
Wow. But they live underground. They build their home, hard as concrete, but they have this breathable structure. And if we can learn from that, then we can create free air conditioning for all of our buildings. But they're hundreds of millions of years older than us and they've designed it to perfection. And we as a species, you know, we're a sneeze at a few hundred thousand. And so we're just trying to catch up by very basically copying their technologies.
I would say to any listener, it is so worth looking up the queen termite because she is kind of disgusting, isn't she, Bridget? She's like, as you say, she's massive, like 100 times bigger, I think, than her mate. And then I think when she goes beyond her usefulness, all the other termites come in and lick her to death.
There are worse ways to go, you know, far worse.
Yeah, maybe that's quite pleasant, licked to death by your subjects.
Sounds like a great party to me.
I know, I'd love it. Let's go.
All right, well, this sounds like a brilliant idea. We do need to display it in the museum. And like you say, termite mounds are just the tip of their iceberg, aren't they? So how are we going to display this mound without inconveniencing the termites?
I do know that termites are very hard to display. And I think only one known zoo displays them because they just escape. So obviously we wouldn't want the exhibits to be eaten. So we'd have to have a totally self-contained room.
Okay.
There's just been the largest underground megacity has been discovered in Brazil, which is the size of Britain. So I think I want to display that one.
The size of Britain?
Yeah.
I think this is going to work. Let's have the giant Brazilian one, which you've cheated there because actually I believe that constitutes 200 million termite mounds in that one. So we'll squeeze all 200 million of those mounds into the museum. Thank you very much for offering them to us.
Thank you, Bridget. We've got to be a little bit careful, though, with the security, because in the words of the proverb of the Bahia people of Tanzania, he who guards two termite hills returns empty-handed. Make of that what you will.
So finally, Lev, what would you like to give to the Museum of Curiosity?
I would like to donate a megalodon tooth, please.
Okay, and can you describe for us what we're getting if we get a megalodon tooth? What's a megalodon
sure.
and what's its tooth like?
Right, so a megalodon is a sort of prehistoric shark, a very, very big one. They were around between 20 million and about 3 billion years ago. And they were about 15 meters long. So very, very big, about the size of a sort of, you know, big double-decker bus. So these Whoa. Things were huge. And their teeth are, you know, representatively bigger as well. They're up to about 17 centimeters long. They're absolutely massive. And they, you know, big triangular-shaped things. And I was actually given a Megalodon tooth once. I was in a place called the Darien Gap, which is, it's a place that very few people go to. And the tribe that lives there, called the Mbera Wunan tribe, they very rarely leave their villages. And many of them had never seen the sea before. So it was no surprise then when I turned up at this village and an old lady said, "Would you like to buy my Thunderbolt?" And I was very curious as to see what her Thunderbolt looked like. And actually, Pliny the Elder also said in his journals many all those years ago that he believed that these teeth originated in space and they came from the sky during lunar eclipses. And this is obviously a myth that has sort of spread around the world. And this old lady showed me this Megalodon tooth and said, "This is what they call in Spanish an uña de raya." So it's the nail of the thunder. And she genuinely believed it was a thunderbolt.
Wow.
And it's quite understandable because when lightning strikes these trees in the middle of the forest, it uproots them. And of course, that's when these fossils were exposed for the first time. And she gave me this tooth, and it's come all the way from the Darien Gap, and now I'm going to hand it over to you for the museum.
Oh, that's wonderful. So did the tooth get there in the middle of nowhere because of the sort of tectonic plates of the movement of mountains and seas and so on?
Yes, all of South America would have been underwater at that stage. Wow. So these massive sharks were swimming all around the world's oceans. I think they pretty much, these teeth have been found pretty much on every continent, I think, except Antarctica. So
yeah, just remind me that when they first started finding sort of bits of the sea, like seashells on the tops of mountains, I think it was Voltaire who said that he thought the explanation for this, it was like Stone Age people who used to like picnics and they'd take seafood up to the top of mountains for the view. Talking about megalodon teeth, do termites have teeth?
They have mandibles that can cut through mostly anything. And the soldier termites have the sharpest mandibles in the world. And they can cut through absolutely anything, especially their enemies. And like literally behead them very quickly. It's wow. really impressive.
We should say, even though it is very special that you're donating this megalodon tooth, they're actually not super uncommon, are they? And this is why shark teeth are quite often collected. Sharks are just constantly shedding their teeth. I think they get through about 40,000 teeth in a lifetime.
Yeah, they're just dropping out left, right and centre. So if you're lucky, you can pick them up on the beach.
Yeah, keep an eye out. Finally, Lev, how do you want this megalodon tooth displayed? Do you want it like hanging from the ceiling like a sword of Damocles?
Well, I mentioned, you know, Pliny, and he was obviously into his megalodon tooth. I think it would go nicely on your Pliny plinth, I think.
Yes,
oh, yes.
Very your good
brand,
idea.
Your brand new one, I think that'd be great.
Well, thank you, Lev. Your megalodon tooth will sit well on Plinth the Elder in the expanding dentistry wing of the museum next to Nina Conti's set of false teeth and Sean Keaveney's old-fashioned tube of toothpaste. So there we have it. The museum's collection now holds a termite mound, a megalodon tooth and a Game Boy Color. A wonder of the natural world, a wonder of the nautical world and a wonderful dose of 90s nostalgia. I'd like to thank Sakisa, Bridget and Levison, and I leave you with these wise words from Terry Pratchett. Wisdom comes from experience. Experience is often a result of lack of wisdom. That's all from the museum this time and this series. Goodbye.
The Museum of Curiosity was curated by John Lloyd and me, Anna Tyshinsky. The donors were Sakisa Bostick-Barnes, Bridget Nichols and Levison Wood. The exhibits were catalogued by Mike Turner, Mandy Fenton, Jade Gebby, Cameron Loxdale and Lydia Meisen. The producers were Sam Holmes and Li Ying Li, and it was a BBC Studios production for Radio 4.
And that concludes the series, but all of the episodes are available now over on BBC Sounds.
The music spectrum is vast, and classical runs right through that. As a composer and an artist, it's been a constant in my life. I'm Devante Hines, aka Blood Orange, and this is Composed, a series of musical discovery where I share my inspirations. The innovators, and overlooked artists. Exposed with me, Devante Hines. Listen on BBC Sounds.